Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
A coup government that has total control of all the state institutions, putting into place kind of a neoliberalism on steroids. Maybe the insane example of this that I could point out is this program called Charter Cities. So there's this area of Trujillo on the northern coast of Honduras that they're going to make a charter city, and they're going to give 30 square kilometers over to essentially corporations. And the government will be essentially elected through investment.
That's the voice of Jesse Freeston, independent journalist for the Real News Network. On this week's show, we check in with Jesse on the Occupy movement in Canada and the ongoing repression and neoliberal experiment that's going on in Honduras. So stay tuned.
Throw your hands up.
incredible music and lyrics of Michael Franti and that song, Yale Fire. We have fires of revolution worldwide. We have people rising up in Europe, people rising up in South America, people fighting back against military coup governments in Honduras, and people right here in Canada taking the streets. To report on this, we have Jesse Friston. He's an independent journalist. He joined us from Occupy Montreal. Thank you for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Sylvia. Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Tell us what is going on in Montreal.
All right. So today we're at Square Victoria, Victoria Square. This is the financial center of Montreal. It's, you know, the Montreal equivalent of the Wall Street occupation or Bay Street in Toronto. I'm looking around. I see the major Scotiabank building, the major Toronto Dominion building, the Montreal Stock Exchange, the Montreal World Trade Center. It's all here. And Quebecor, the major owner of the media here, and the owner of the Sun Chain. Lots of music going on, lots of speeches being given, lots of tents have been set up. I'd say about 10 large tents have been set up, setting up the food area, setting up the area for kids to play. I've seen lots of kids having a good time around here. And people are out sort of fulfilling that story that's been popping up in the corporate media all over the place, that these people don't have a message. They're talking about everything. It's like there's more than one problem with this world or something, because people are here talking about police brutality. Well, I just met some Chilean teachers that are here trying to tell people about what's going on in Chile right now with the ongoing strike and the upcoming general strike in Chile. Met some workers from McGill University that are on strike, the support staff. And they've been on strike for a few weeks now, and McGill's been trying to tell everybody that, oh, everything's working fine, we don't need these petty support workers, and they can strike as long as they want. But a bunch of professors were down here saying that they had just done a press conference to tell the media that the professors are suffering without their support staff, despite the fact that the administration's been trying to tell everybody that the strike's not having any effect. You know, met some people down here who haven't been to a protest since they were protesting for the right to a woman's choice, since they fought for the right to abortion. Lots of newly unemployed people down here, lots of people with problems with the banking system. Lots of people talking about immigration, talking about the upcoming G20 in France, and a whole congregation of people talking about decolonization and trying to talk about the fact that Montreal is in many ways already occupied, not just by banks, but also by settlers, and that this is on unceded indigenous land, like, you know, this whole continent is. So yeah, it's quite an impressive showing so far.
You just came back from the heart of revolutionary movements in Honduras to speak about the contrast. If you could talk a little bit about what is happening in Honduras and the kind of resistance that you're seeing there against the military coup government of Pepe Lobos.
There's a lot going on in Honduras. And so if people aren't familiar, I'm not sure where people are at with Honduras. There was a military coup in 2009 that not just deposed the president, but also deposed a movement that was seeking to rewrite the constitution. So on the day of the coup, there was going to be a referendum over whether or not the people wanted to or were interested in rewriting the constitution. And that was the day that that the military overthrew the president and stopped that referendum from happening. And we're still seeing the continuation of that government was put into place. They had some sham elections that were completely unobserved and, for all intents and purposes, not very well attended. And that continues today in the form of the person you just mentioned, Pepe Lobo, who's now the head of that regime, the inheritor of the coup. And what we've seen in the country since the coup is two very, very drastically different projects going on. So one is the building of that movement for a new constitution, and as it starts to define itself and define how it's going to get there, while on the other hand, a coup government that has total control of all the state institutions, putting into place kind of a neoliberalism on steroids. Maybe the insane example of this that I could point out is this program called Charter Cities. So there's this area of Trujillo on the northern coast of Honduras that they're going to make a charter city, and they're going to give 30 square kilometers over to essentially corporations. And the government will be essentially elected through investments. So you could picture it as a municipality, whereas instead of every member of the municipality having the right to vote, it's like shareholders, and you invest in the city. And, you know, this experiment was put forward by an economist who trained at the University of Chicago, the same place as Milton Friedman. He was there a little bit after Friedman, but in the same vein. So he went in with this grand scheme, and the Honduran coup regime totally ate it up, and this plan is going into place. It essentially is going to disenfranchise all the people living in that area. This is a government that's being praised for its, you know, quote, in the words of Barack Obama, you know, great progress in democratic governance in terms of handing over large chunks of the country and some of the best, you know, beachfront properties over to this new corporate municipality. But in the face of all this, you see the movement, and it's transitioning into kind of a two-form movement. It had always rejected the idea of participating in elections until such time as there was a new constitution. But I think after 2 years of being repeatedly repressed and tear-gassed in the streets and beaten and watching the international community completely turn its head and watch the Lobo regime just start getting more and more recognition from the international community and start to get more funding from the IMF and more funding from the World Bank and sign a free trade deal with Canada and various things like this happening, that they've decided that they unfortunately do have to participate in elections. Even though there's very little faith that they will be in any way free and fair, the resistance movement has, for the most part, come to the conclusion that it's really their only path at this point. So they formed a political party. It's called Libre, the Freedom Party, I guess would be a good translation. And at the moment, you know, the leader of it is the deposed leader, Manuel Zelaya, who's come back. But likely the candidate in the 2013 elections will be his wife, Xiomara, because under the current constitution, he's not allowed to run again. But given that, though, there's still the other prong of the resistance, which is the direct action side of the resistance. And nowhere is that more clear and more obvious than in two sectors in particular, one being education sector and the other being organized campesinos, small farmers, smaller landless farmers. The farmers continue occupying land that they need to survive and that they need to have a dignified lifestyle, and that's in the northern region as well, up in the Aguan Valley, and that's where we've seen really the most brutal repression on the part of the regime, and they've recently sent in thousands of military into the area. This was actually reported in much of the international press, but it was reported in this very way where it was to be understood that the military was going to bring an end to the violence in the region. You know, there was no explanation. People are dying in the Aguan Valley, and the military is going to go in and stabilize the situation. We've seen the opposite. Ever since the military has gone in there, there's been more murders, and the military has actually participated in some of the violent evictions of some of these farmer camps that are set up in the area. That's sort of what's going on in the Aguan Valley. In the education side of things, it's been really impressive to see the students really get involved in the fight against the privatization of education, which is going on in Honduras. It's one of the post-coup projects. One of the many post-coup projects that's going on is to privatize education. And the students have occupied and walked out of almost every high school in the country, along with, you know, numerous teachers. Teachers have been facing ridiculous repercussions for their political activity. You know, hundreds of teachers being fired without pay, thousands being suspended or being threatened to be fired, and particularly targeting those teachers that take organizing or leadership roles within the teachers' unions, within the teachers' organizations. But it continues. And the really beautiful thing about the movement for a new constitution in Honduras is that it's brought together all these groups that previously had fought separately, like teachers, like farmers, like students. They've become more active in their arena, in their, whether it be their schools or their farms or where it might be in terms of their political activity, but now they also feel the solidarity and a unified project at a national level with the movement for a new constitution. And so you see a lot of solidarity action, you know, the teachers marching with the farmers joining the teachers in their road blockade, and things like this that most people talk about having not occurred prior to the coup.
There were particular aggressions against the teachers that the government imposed. Can you speak to this?
Yeah, the teachers have routinely been seen as a threat because they're probably the largest in terms of numbers organized group in the country. The teachers are, as a group, probably the only group of the working class that at a national level had achieved something that, you know, we might call a middle-class lifestyle. You know, teachers in Honduras have homes. You know, they've been able to buy themselves homes. Sometimes they have internet access. You know, their kids are able to go to college. You know, good food on the table. Teachers have achieved a pretty dignified lifestyle. And through group action, because they've had a national union movement for years that's been very successful at achieving these things. And so that's why they've become, you know, enemy number one of the regime, is that the regime has a lot to gain from taking out the teachers. It can save a lot of money on the amount of money that it has to pay out in terms of pensions, in terms of salaries, in terms of wages to these teachers. But more importantly, there's a lot of money to be made in terms of privatizing education. You know, the vast majority of Hondurans are in the public education system. It is a two-tiered system. There's lots of private schools, but the vast majority are in public schools. And if you are able to continuously weaken that public school system to the point where, you know, close down schools and people are forced to send their kids to private schools faced with the decision of either I send my kid to a private school or they don't go to school, period, many people will probably, you know, maybe not eat meat, you know, anymore and just go to rice and beans so that they can send their kids to private schools. And there's a lot of money to be made in that group of Hondurans. So the teachers are the major force against that. And now, most recently, the students as well have become the only thing really in the path of that happening. And so, as such, they've become a major target. And every time they take to the streets, it's immediately met with tear gas, with beatings, with people being thrown in jail. They get probably the least time of anybody. As soon as they hit the streets, they're finished. When I was there during the month of March and April in particular, it was a daily occurrence in almost every major city in the country that the teachers would take the streets, block a street, and, you know, get beaten in tear gas. And that hasn't ended. It's not as frequent as it was during that particular month, but the crisis there has been very severe in terms of the teachers.
Now, in terms of the campesinos, there has been a growing movement throughout Latin America to take idle lands that were really stolen by, I guess, legislations that awarded the rich rights to lands and displaced a lot of people. So the campesino movement have been taking lands that are idle and cultivating them and occupying them. Can you speak to this struggle and what has been the response by the government?
Yeah, most of the land that's been occupied in Honduras isn't actually idle land. It's actually very productive and very, very lucrative land that's currently producing African palm for palm oil, which is primarily used in lard and various other snack foods, as well as soaps, and has all kinds of uses, but is about to go shoot up in value as the technology to use it in biofuels gets more refined. So that area has been largely occupied by the campesinos in the Aguan Valley. They reference previous land reform laws and constitutional concepts regarding land ownership and say that the current holding of some people, like in particular a man named Miguel Facuse, who owns, you know, tens of thousands of hectares of African palm in the country, when the previous land reform laws said that he could only, for example, in the Aguan Valley, he was only allowed to have 300 hectares. Anybody over 300 hectares, as soon as you can prove that they have over that amount, you're allowed to go in and occupy that land and start working it. And so that's what they're referencing. The thing is that legally, it's a real mess because there's all kinds of laws that contradict one another. There's laws that favor the campesinos, and there's laws that favor the corporations and the oligarchs. But morally, the argument is that as an economic development model, there are African palm cooperatives in Honduras that have been operating for 40 years that are extremely successful. And much like the teachers, but in these very small pockets in the Aguan Valley, you can find cooperatives of campesinos. There's some communities where every child in the community has a full scholarship. The community itself provides free health care. You know, everybody has a vehicle. Everybody is doing very well, and they're farmers. They're doing the exact same daily activity as the farmer that's making $3 a day working for Facuse. So it's been seeing this model happen and then being empowered by the idea of a new constitution and fighting back against the coup that has really created a movement to just occupy all this land and force the country to move into a cooperative agricultural model as opposed to a corporate agricultural model. And, of course, this has threatened the very basis of the oligarchs' power, you know, their land. You know, they're losing millions and millions and millions of dollars while the teachers get tear gas, and the odd teacher leader has been assassinated. That has to be pointed out. The campesinos are being killed. The campesinos are being eliminated and cleansed one by one. There's been about 50 campesinos selectively assassinated since the coup, and about 36 of those were involved in occupying land that belongs to this one person, Miguel Facuse. They also, one journalist, Honduras has become the deadliest place in the world for journalists. Ever since Lobo took power, there's been 15 critical journalists that have been assassinated. One journalist who didn't have a line of being critical against the government who was assassinated or killed, but 15 of which who had clear lines of taking positions and covering stories that were not in the interest of the regime that have been assassinated. Per capita, that's by far the highest in the world. And one of those journalists that was assassinated was by the name of Naum Palacios. He was killed 1 week after doing an expose, a video television expose on the campesinos of the Aguan. And he was the first Honduran video journalist to actually go into the occupation and spend a week there and film their lives and speak to everybody. And not just speak to their leaders, but speak to the women and speak to the children, because all the leadership is particularly male. So he was showing this human side of the campesinos that the mainstream media typically calls terrorists or calls communists or finds various other ways to dehumanize. And so he was killed a week after that report was released. The partner, Mario, that he made the report with, actually had to go into exile after he escaped an attempted assassination and only recently came back. And so, you know, this is the kind of situation that the campesinos are under. And, you know, far from bringing an end to their movement with all this violence, it seems to just be strengthening it. And more land is being occupied, then they get violently evicted, and they go back in and they occupy again. And they are really one of the most active parts of this national resistance, and certainly the part that's affecting the bottom line of the people that finance and organize the coup on a day-to-day basis.
And that's an important story. Now, there is also another aspect that you've covered thoroughly, and that is the role of mining companies in the country.
Yeah, primarily Canadian companies. There's three major Canadian-owned gold mines in Honduras. I'm not as up-to-date on this story as much, but what I can say is that Zelaya, the overthrown president, before he was overthrown, about a year before, when looking at some of the environmental and particularly human health concerns that were coming out of one of the mines at the Suria Valley in northern Honduras, decided to put a moratorium on not any new mine leases or permission. About 30% of Honduras' territory is already concessioned for exploration, the vast majority of that to Canadian companies. And for those who not know, out there in Vancouver, you're sitting on the majority of the mining companies in the world. 60% of mining companies in the world are actually incorporated in Canada for various legal reasons, and the support that they get from the Canadian government in terms of financing, taxation breaks, as well as the fact that often, particularly in Latin America, where my experience is, I don't know about other places, where the Canadian embassy often acts more like a marketing arm for mining companies than it does, you know, how you would particularly imagine the role of an embassy being. Anyways, so in Honduras, Zelaya, before being overthrown, about a year or so before being overthrown, put a moratorium on new mining permissions. Immediately after the coup, and this is actually detailed in WikiLeaks as well, there was meetings organized between the coup leadership and Canadian mining companies. At one of the meetings, the Canadian ambassador was present. And now they're reopening up the mining thing. We're seeing a lot of arguments in the corporate-owned newspapers, a lot of editorials being put out about how mining could be the savior of the Honduran economy. And it's really ahistorical, because the type of mining and the type of mining ownership model that they're talking about has already been in place in Central America for a long time. And, you know, studies show, Oxfam's done some really good investigating on this, studies by Oxfam show that actually even locally in the areas around the mines, it becomes economically depressed within 10 years of the mine closing. And the average length of lifespan of a gold mine is no more than 10 years. So it's a kind of boom economy that isn't even that boomy to begin with, in the way that, you know, we in Canada imagine like a tar sands boom, because the wages that people are getting are only slightly above, you know, the wages that they would get, you know, doing the sharecropping farm work or other jobs that are around. And most of the, you know, technical jobs and things go to people coming in from out of country. The current situation in Honduras is that the companies on the money that they make from gold mining pay 1% tax locally and 1% tax nationally, and 98% of their revenues goes back to Canada or to their shareholders in whatever country they might live in.
And that, you know, brings us back to our need to rise up locally as well, because many of the companies in Canada, many of the corporations that are, drying up the jobs in Canada to export them to be, you know, exploitive in other parts of the world, are not contributing to our well-being either. We may think that because that 98% is coming to Canada, maybe that's benefiting us, but it's not. We're coming to the end of our interview. Tell us why it's important for people to come and participate, or why are you covering the Occupy Montreal today? Why do you see this as an important event?
Well, I think it's great for people to come and see sort of a different model for decision making. For a lot of people here, this is their first experience with, you know, a consensus building model of decision making, and really to come and see why it is that there's no concrete demands coming out of these occupations, because they're not about making a demand to an existing government. It's about, you know, practicing a different way to make decisions, a different way you could organize society. And so, you know, maybe at some point it will form into some concrete demands and to be made to existing legislators and things like that. But for the most part, it's a really great way to come and meet people that are pissed off for various reasons and hear their stories and tell your stories and be a part of something. And I think it's particularly inspiring that it started up in October in North America, you know, that people are coming out and braving the elements. This is as exciting as anything that happens in this country.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, Jesse Friston is an independent journalist. Most of his reports can be seen, heard on The Real News. So how do people access your work?
So you can check out, I just recently put up a 25-minute mini documentary on the repression that journalists are facing in Honduras, and getting to meet some of the journalists that have survived really the cleansing of critical journalism in Honduras. And it's called, if you want to search for it, it's called The Deadliest Place in the World for a Journalist. So that's the most recent work I went on. It's up on the Real News website. You can also find it on YouTube, or just punch it into Google and I'm sure it'll come up. Yeah, and the Real News website is at www.therealnews.com, and that's REAL.com.
Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure, Sylvia.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.